Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Angela Lansbury, an exclusive trip into the TCM archives with the complete conversation I had on October 31st, 2005, with the lady who's conquered movies, the stage, and television like no other. Now, it was Halloween that day, but my time with Angela was anything but scary. It was, in fact, quite the opposite. It was a delightful 2 hours, of which only an hour of the interview made it onto TCM. But you can now hear the entire interview completely uncut. Angela was funny that day, charming, extremely open as she discussed her amazingly diverse career, which began when she was still a teenager. Angela was just 17 years old when she made her very first film, in a meaty role opposite Ingrid Bergman, Charles Boyer, and Joseph Cotten in the MGM thriller Gaslight. And in this first part of our conversation, Angela shares some of her memories of making that film, as well as some classics that she made, such as The Picture of Dorian Gray and The Harvey Girls, along with recollections about working with and around such Hollywood legends as Judy Garland, Louis B. Mayer, and Ethel Barrymore. She also talks about her marriage to actor Peter Shaw and her unusual contribution to the 1962 film The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Here's part one of the show, which originally aired on TCM August 1st, 2006, TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Angela Lansbury. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you being here. We've been after you to come and visit with us for a long time, so I'm really happy it's happening.
Well, I think it's wonderful that we're sitting here together. It's been many years since we've done
this. Yes, indeed. At the very start of Turner Classic Movies, when we went on the air.
Yes.
You had us out to the set of Murder, She Wrote.
Mm-hmm.
We had a nice visit. But I'm glad to be able to sit with you again and talk and get caught up.
Talk about the real work.
The real work, yes. Now, you have had truly one of the extraordinary careers. I mean, I don't know how you perceive it, but from somebody looking at it, mm-hmm. I don't know of anyone else that has triumphed so wonderfully in movies and stage and television as you. And I wondered to know how you perceive it.
Well, now I'm getting to a stage in my life when I can stop and look back and say, what have I done? What have I achieved here? What has it all been about? And I'm kind of interested and amazed too that I managed to kind of compartmentalize my career in such a way that it's in really three parts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take each separately, there are those in the audience who don't know that I was in the first section,
mm-hmm.
and those who don't know that I was in the second section,
right.
But they only know me from the third section. And so it's been so varied, and I do see it's pretty kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, because also you weren't just in it. I mean, you really triumphed in it. I mean, very few people have had a success like Manchurian Candidate that people still talk about today all these years later, and Jessica Fletcher on television,
yeah.
And Mame on Broadway. I mean, besides all the other things. I mean, those were not just, you didn't just do them, though. I mean, those were great triumphs.
Well, they all took a certain piece of time of my life,
mm-hmm.
and I just put my all into those pieces as they came up. And I was always felt challenged and always described myself as having been given incredible opportunities. But people were, big and kind enough to offer me things that just came out of the blue in some instances,
right.
That I didn't expect. But in my heart of hearts, I was hoping would happen, you know, like going into the theater big time. I hoped that would happen, but I didn't know how. Going into the musical theater. Oh, I dreamed of it. Not in a stupid way, but I just wanted to have a go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, along came Stephen Sondheim and offered me Anyone Can Whistle. So those are opportunities,
right.
You know. And
but you also had periods when the opportunities weren't really there, but you kind of took it and had a plan, and we'll get into all of that. You once said that you were, it was drummed into you early on that you could do anything. And where did that come from?
I think it came from my mother,
mm-hmm.
from Moina. She believed, although she wasn't a pushy mother at all, not at all, she simply allowed me, exposed me to the best always. She
mm-hmm.
gave me the opportunity to be taught in the best places and to achieve the kind of training that you know, I might never have gone and found on my own.
Now, your mother was an actress,
yes.
Moyna McGill, and she has a great, great moment in one of our TCM movies that we have, The Clock, with Keenan Wynn, the Judy Garland, Robert Walker movie, where she is extraordinary. And when people see her face in The Clock, you know, she is really wonderful.
She was a wonderful comedian.
Yeah. Now, you were born in London in 1925. And raised in London. How did you get from London to the United States, and why?
Well, you know, I've always described myself as being one of the bundles from Britain.
Uh-huh.
Because I arrived as an evacuee with my twin brothers and my mother. Luckily, she was able to accompany us. And we arrived in New York City on August the 24th, 1940. And we were sponsored by a wonderful American family.
Now, your father had died.
My father had died in 1935, so my mother was left not in an enviable financial situation.
Right. So there's you and their twin brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And just the four of us.
Uh-huh.
Landed in New York, and we took off from there. We lived for 2 years as the guests of the Wilson family, and then we got our green cards. We're the personification of the American dream. We really, really are, the whole family.
What was New York like in 1940?
To me, of course, and to all of my family, we were just amazed. I remember riding in a taxi cab with a glass roof. They used to have them with glass roofs, and you could look up and see the skyscrapers, and in the early evening when the lights were just coming on. And in those days, everybody was walking. The yellow cabs were on the streets. It was a much slower, a fast town, but slower, compared to what it is today.
Right.
It was a smaller town. It was more personal. And it was so glamorous. I mean, the stores were so magnificent. We'd never seen anything like those windows displays and things like that. I mean, we were just boondoggled by it. It was wonderful.
Really. You ever look at it today when you go back to New York? You know, and having been the toast of Broadway in New York, and see places that you saw and remember those days when you first saw
it? Oh, yes, of course
I do. That memory trip?
I remember the corner of 50th Street and Madison Avenue. It used to be a little drugstore there. And you'd go in there, and they would make you a Coke, but they made the Coke out of a press button machine at the back, and then they put club soda in it, I guess, or aerated water. And that Coke was the best thing. I mean, you'd live to get to that drugstore to get that Coke, and then you'd get on the bus, the Madison Avenue bus, and go uptown. But, you know, every time I pass that corner, I think of that. And, of course, it's very glamorous now, you know.
Yes.
All different.
Mm-hmm. Was your mother now an actress trying to get acting work in New York?
She was, but she wasn't able to. At that point, when we first got there, she couldn't work. She didn't have the papers. You see, she didn't have working papers. But what she did do was she was very clever, and because what she did was she would give lectures, and she would do recitations, and she was hired by some of the best schools in New York to go around and do recitations. Mm. She did the White Cliffs of Dover. She'd do sort of heroic poems and that sort of thing. And sometimes she'd take me with her, and we would do scenes from Shakespeare. We would do the Juliet and the nurse scene in Romeo and Juliet. And it gave me a little practice.
And did that start your passion for acting then?
No, it had already started in London, you see. Before I left, I had started to train in London at the Webber Douglas School of...
So you knew early on?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew by then. I was 14 then, and I knew that was what I was going to go for.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the school, drama school in New York City for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in New York City, did you see a lot of plays and some of those great stars and actors that
yes,
were in
I did.
The theater
I,
then?
I certainly did, because I got to stay with a family in New York City while I was studying, because it was a big trip to go back up to Lake Mayopac in New York State, which is where Moyna and the two boys were.
Mm-hmm.
So during the week, while I was at school in New York City, I stayed with the Perkins family, and they lived up on East 94th Street. Mrs. Perkins used to take me to the theater. She was a lovely lady, and she took me to see some of the great ladies of the time. I saw you've got to help me out who they were. But I certainly saw Helen Hayes and
probably
and
Ina Claire and Catherine Cornell.
Ina Claire, Catherine Cornell, definitely saw her. And went to the symphony, heard great concerts, was introduced to great classical music. I had an incredibly good education.
Yeah, so that would just
the
feed
arts.
Also your enthusiasm,
yes,
I'm
of course,
sure.
Yes.
Yeah, and you went to the stage door canteen, I understand.
I did, right there. Where, what's there now? A place you get hot dogs and stuff. It's on that corner.
Oh, 40, like a Nathan's?
40, yeah. It's right there. It was right there.
Right.
I remember going in there and we'd dance with the boys and that was, it was lovely. That was.
Now, great. You were also singing then, right?
I was starting to sing, starting to learn how to sing, how to, my voice was never trained as a trained voice, but I certainly learned how to use my voice. I had a natural voice, and I didn't have to worry too much about it. It was always there, and it was on the basis of that voice that I really got started in my career, because I finished in drama school. There was a young man there who taught me a complete act that I could utilize all of my talents for doing
like
various.
Like a cabaret act kind of thing?
Yes, it was like a cabaret act. And I did an audition at Roseland, which was in the Roseland building, you know.
Right.
And I got a job. I was hired by an agent who got me a job. And it was up in Canada, up in Montreal. And
doing your act.
Doing
my act.
So you
were what now, all of 15
I was,
or 16?
I was 16.
16?
I lied about my age.
Uh-huh.
And said I was 19. And I went up there, and I stayed up there for 4 weeks.
And now, it's very interesting, too, because you've always said that you're basically, and were, terribly shy in growing up, to be attracted to something where you're in a profession in which you kind of have to show off all the time.
Well, this was my way of being allowed to get outside myself.
Uh-huh.
And as long as I was playing a role, I was not self-conscious. And that's true to this day. If anybody asked me to stand up and sing a song, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
Really?
No, because I don't have any shield between.
Because that's Angela doing it.
That's
right?
Angela, yes. And Angela isn't really this, 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 or this. But if you give me a script and say, well, you're playing a person who is this, 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 and so, I will study up on that, and that's what I will project, you know. But and people have never quite understood that about me. Well, doesn't matter. We all have our little quirks and idiosyncrasies.
You also said one time that the one thing you always had confidence in was your talent.
I knew it.
That must be a wonderful thing to have from a young age.
Yes.
Make you fearless.
Well, yes. Yes. I have to say that I did believe that I could do things. And that my mother also helped me tremendously with that. She had a philosophy, a wonderful philosophy, and she said, you know, you are what you believe you are and what you believe you can be. And she said to me, you have the talent. Now, just use it. Let it work through you. It's going to work through you. Isn't you. Your talent is going to work through you. And that was a good way for me to think of it.
An interesting thing about your mother, she was always a working actress, and certainly one I was aware of when I would see her in movies, who Moina McGill was, but she never had a great success as an actress, I mean, great fame as an actress, and you did. Was there ever any conflict or competition from her
because
of that, or jealousy, do you think?
Never competition. I think there was a certain regret.
Uh-huh.
Very truthfully, I do believe so. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. But the thing I remind myself, and my brothers have, oh, we've talked about this, because obviously it's something that we were aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when I suddenly became the toast of Broadway, you know. She had been the toast of the West End when she was a young woman, and had given up the theater for a family. So when my brothers were born, the twins, she gave up acting in the theater. And she could never quite get the confidence back.
Mm-hmm.
She was a person who did not have a tremendous amount of self-confidence. She really didn't. And she was such a beautiful woman and such a tender, lovely actress that she was very easily bruised. Do you know what I mean? And the whole pace and the rate of life, in, particularly in America, was very difficult for her to lock into. So there were times when I think she felt, this isn't, I love this for my daughter, but I wish I could be up there too, you know?
Because she didn't quite get that herself.
Yeah. L.B. Mayer put her under contract to MGM for, I think she was there for 3 years. And she made a few movies there, Green Dolphin Street and Three Daring Daughters, with Jeanette MacDonald and Jose Iturbe. That's a movie you haven't run for a while.
Yes, we have, actually.
Have
and
you
Jane
really?
Powell, yes, indeed.
Got to have a sip of this.
Yes, okay. Now, New York, you spent a couple of years in New York, and then why California? Why Hollywood?
Again, I have to come back to Moina. She got a job with Pixie Hardwick. Now, does that name ring a
no,
bell?
No bells
no,
at all.
No, 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 okay. Herbert Wilcox, Herbert Wilcox, yes.
That rings a bell, producer in England.
That's right.
And
his wife at that time was Lady Hardwick. I've got it all mixed up. Anyway, she organized this tour across Canada in aid of the Canadian RCAF, which was the Royal Canadian Air Force. And they were training British pilots. So they were raising money for the Canadian Air Force. And they did Tonight at 8:30. And they stopped at all
Noel
the little
Coward
cities.
Plays.
Noel Coward plays. And Moina was in those. She played a lot of different parts with a lot of wonderful actors. And she ended up in Los Angeles. I was still in New York with my twin brothers. So she got in touch with me and she said, you know, it's much cheaper to live out here. And I think that we might have a chance to get into the movies. So why don't you pack up the apartment in New York, which was a one room down on Morton Street in the village, and where we all lived together, all four of us sleeping in that tiny little place. And I did that. I sent the boys off to school. They had, what do you call it? They went to the Choate
Cadets
School
the
for nothing.
Military school kind of thing?
They went to Choate, actually.
Oh, scholarships.
They had scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went back to school, and I went out to the coast on a sit-up train and ended up in Los Angeles in 1942.
And that's right, smack in the middle of the Second World War.
That's right.
And what was California like then?
California was just all big red geraniums and very
and space.
Dry. Space, dry as all get out, not much grass, wonderful palms, and, you know, it was Southern California. That was the most romantic thing I'd ever seen in my life, was to be, you know, in the place where I'd seen these pictures in movie magazines as a child, you know. I used to tell people, we used to buy these secondhand movie magazines at Woolworths in England when I was a kid, and they would see all these, you know, these glamorous folk. In those days, the movie stars were glamorous, and I had a terrific crush on Errol Flynn. I really did. So I used to buy everything I could lay my hands on about Errol Flynn, and he lived out there, you know. Do you know, I never got to meet him.
Didn't you?
Even though we were there at the same time, we were moving probably very close to
circles.
Each other. Yes,
yeah.
I never got to meet him.
Oh, what a pity. Maybe you would have been disappointed.
Maybe I would.
Maybe
yes.
not.
Yes.
So in California then, did you start trying to hit studios and trying to get acting jobs and things like
that?
Well,
you know, you can't just hit studios. You have to have an agent.
Right.
And my mother had better luck than I did because she had a reputation.
Right.
And she knew a lot of the English actors who were out in Hollywood, like Basil Rathbone and Sarah Allgood and
And being
Barry
a character
Fitzgerald.
Actress, too.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, although she, of course, was not a character actress at that time. I mean, she was still very beautiful looking. So it was hard for her to get work, and she really didn't succeed. And I certainly couldn't. I couldn't get in the studio gate, you know. But finally, through a friend, I did. And this was a young man who was being considered for the part of Dorian Gray. Meanwhile, I had to get a job, you know. I couldn't just sit around. We needed the money. So I went to work at Bullock's Wilshire, which was a very, very grand, beautiful Art Deco building on Wilshire Boulevard.
Right.
And I became a sales lady, you know. I went in as a cashier, and I learned how to wrap packages, and I made $18, $19 a week, and I ended up making about $30 a week, and that was a lot of money then. It really was. So we thought we were on our way.
And that was kind of supporting the family then.
Yes, It was helping to support mm-hmm. the family, because although we were still supported to a certain extent by the family who brought us over, but we were coming to the point where we wanted to get on our own, mm-hmm. you know.
You also said one time, just to interject, that you were never really an adolescent.
No.
That you, so you kind of had, like your, when your father died, his mm-hmm. responsibilities looking after your brothers and mm-hmm. helping out with the family and all of that.
That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I missed a whole chunk of growing up. I mean, I just grew up like that. And so I missed out a lot of the fun of, mm-hmm. of that kind of adolescent period, although I was, in other words, responsibility was forced on me, and I just didn't even realize it at the time. I was rather proud of the fact that I was considered like a friend by my mother, mm-hmm. and she certainly lent on me a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then when my success came first, even more so, because I was able to help mm-hmm. a little bit with educating my brothers. You know, they went to college and things like that, which in those days was very reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So you met this young actor that was up, Michael Dane, was
Michael
that his
Dine.
Name?
Michael Dine.
Dine,
D-Y-N-E.
That was up for...
He was up for the part of Dorian Gray.
In the picture of
yes.
Dorian Gray, okay.
And he arranged, they were looking for an actress to play Sybil Vane, you see. And he talked to the casting director and suggested that they should see me. That he and I knew one another from these various little tea parties that the British colony in Hollywood had in those days.
And these were the Brits that
the Brits.
Were living in, during the war, were living in Hollywood and working there.
Exactly.
And they kind of clustered together.
They certainly did. And, you know, there was a whole crowd of them, actually. There were some very interesting people living in Hollywood during the war, people who'd come from Germany, from all over the place, who would... you know, refugees and people, and some of them were great artists, musicians, actors, mm. and that whole crowd, we all sort of moved. You could call us Eurotrash today, you know, we were sort of moved around.
Well, let me ask you, did you feel like an outsider at that point, being a Brit in America?
Yes.
And all of that?
Yes.
You did?
Yes. We were made to feel very, very much at home, don't misunderstand me, but I mean, nevertheless, it was a big adjustment
right.
for us.
So you kind of looked for your kind,
yeah.
people that
yeah, we
had
did.
Something in common.
Yes, well, I think uh-huh. we did. The great actress Flora Robson was mm-hmm. tremendously helpful to me, and I admired her so much. And in fact, we took over a little house that she rented, and when I got my first job, we were able to pay that rent. So the first job being under contract to MGM.
So anyway, back to Dorian Gray.
Back to Dorian Gray. I went to the studio with Moina. Had to have her with me because I was underage. And they didn't want to let you wander around studios without your mother or a welfare worker with you.
So anyway, he was already up for the part
mm-hmm.
and had that clout to be able to bring you in and introduce you to the people.
Yes, he did.
Okay,
yes,
wonderful
he did.
Of him.
It was a wonderful,
generous.
Wonderful, generous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know that anybody would have ever known that I existed had he not brought me into the studio, because of course on that occasion I not only got to meet the producer and the director of the picture of Dorian Gray, but I also met George Cukor, who was the director of Gaslight.
Okay, so now you met these people, and was it a slam dunk right away when they met you about Dorian Gray?
Well, let's put it this way, there was really great excitement, to be perfectly honest with you.
And you're 17 at this point.
I was 17.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they knew my mother, you see, not George Cukor, but the screenwriter of Gaslight knew her.
John Van Druten.
John Van Druten. John knew her from London, from her days in the West End as a leading lady.
Uh-huh.
And so there was immediately conversation, shall we say. And this wasn't some kid who came in out
right.
of nowhere. This was the daughter of an established actress. So that was a tremendous help.
Uh-huh.
And George Cukor was terribly excited. Did you know George?
Yes, I did.
You talked
yes,
to him.
Yes, I did.
You know how George would get, he would talk so fast that he'd lose his place in what
mm-hmm.
he was saying. Well, he was terribly excited when we first met, because he thought, gosh, this is incredible. You know, this girl, she can do Cockney. She's a trained actress.
So actually you were brought there for Dorian Gray,
mm-hmm.
but in the meantime, they said, we got a part in another picture mm-hmm. that she'd be good for as well.
Exactly.
So that started that wheel going.
That's exactly what happened. Mm. Whereas I thought I was going to be ending up maybe having a chance to test for Dorian Gray, I tested for Gaslight instead. And then the awful moment arrived where they decided I was too young for the Gaslight.
Well, and because you're playing a rather seductive, saucy maid opposite mm-hmm. Charles Boyer, who was considerably older than you were.
Indeed.
And also kind of competing for the affections of Ingrid Bergman, who was also older. So you are in kind of a different age range.
Yes, very, very much so. So I had to act a lot uh-huh. a lot more sophisticated and worldly in every sense.
George Cukor once said about you to me that he never saw anyone who took to a camera more mm-hmm. readily than you did mm-hmm. and was more professional so quickly.
It's curious,
he was
isn't
amazed.
It?
Well, where did that come from?
I don't know, but I always behaved as if the camera wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I just never, although he felt that I did and that I used the camera. In fact, I didn't. I didn't think I was. Maybe I was. You know, one does things by osmosis sometimes. And I was very, very comfortable with it, I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did they get over the age
Well, they
barrier?
Padded me out tremendously. They really did. They put, padding all around, and they made me much bigger and heftier. And they gave me high-heeled shoes so that I would tower over Ingrid, because Ingrid was a very tall woman. She was 5'9". I was 5'8", and 8.5". I'm 5'8.5". I'm kind of losing little bits along the way, but so to make me bigger and stronger than she was, because she was a very robust woman, mm-hmm. really, if you remember.
Big Swedish lady.
Yes, she mm-hmm. was. And and Charles Boyer, of course, was rather short,
mm-hmm.
so he used to wear kind of Western boots, which was used to jack him up mm-hmm. a little bit. I always remember he had a stand-in called Fig Newton.
Like that.
And he used to go around in sort of shoes with big blocks on the bottom, because he was even shorter
Carmen
than
Miranda shoes.
Charles. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they were. It was so funny.
So So your first film then is Gaslight, and you're playing one of the leads with these two great stars, and three great stars actually, Joseph Cotten mm-hmm. in the film as well.
Yes.
George Cukor directing. How did they treat you on the set? You had never done a film before, and you were a real novice. But did they treat you well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as far as the cast treated me wonderfully well. Mind you, I minded my P's and Q's.
Yes.
I didn't go around looking for conversation. I didn't try to impose myself beyond doing the job. I was self-conscious and shy enough, as you know, not to want to sort of come on too strong. I had nothing to come on strong about, you know. If anybody asked me a question, I would, you know, answer the question. And we never became social, shall we mm-hmm. say.
But that's maybe where never being an adolescent came in handy. You were
yes.
grown up for your age.
Yes, yes. I was very grown up for my age. Mm-hmm. I was, yes. And I was very aware, very interested in the kind of different departments, you know. I became very friendly with the property master,
mm-hmm.
George Elder. I remember his name to this day, you know. And the way they did their work, they wore ties, they wore hats. It was so interesting, the whole way people worked in those days. And I was aware and watching how they would look after the director. They would always bring him his cigarettes, and they would bring him his drinks at the end of the day, and all of this kind of stuff that goes on, that went on sets in those days. It doesn't anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, maybe a little bit.
Now, when you were already under contract now to MGM
yes.
when you did that, and I understand that when your screen test was seen by Louis B. Mayer, who had to see every piece of film that went through the mm-hmm. studio, that he's the one who said, sign her.
Absolutely. It was at that point that they made the jump cut decision that they were going to use me in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't want to jump ahead here, but you know, I from there I went into actually went into National Velvet,
right,
and then into
Picture of Dorian
yeah.
Gray. So we hear such horrendous stories about Louis B. Mayer. What was your take on him?
Well, the only horrendous thing I have, as far as my association with LB, was he was a good gin player, and I used to play gin with him, and. But I also argued with him on a couple of occasions about roles. I wanted to play a certain role. I didn't want to do If Winter Comes, for instance.
Right.
And I went to him and said, why are you making me do this? You know, I just done, you know, what had I done at that point? I'd done the Harvey Girls. And I didn't want to play this drag of a wife.
So, because number one, you're a very young girl, and that's like a mature woman who's
very mature, too mature.
And working opposite Walter Pigeon and Deborah Carr.
Yes.
Yeah,
and Deborah and I were of an age, you know, and I thought, why am I doing this? And I wanted to play the part of Rosie, which was played by Janet Leigh. Mm-hmm. That's the part I would have wanted to play. But they wouldn't think of it.
I think I should interject here that you were actually born Bridget Angela Lansbury, right?
Angela Bridget Lansbury.
Oh, okay, the other way around. Mm-hmm. But your family called you Bridget?
They called me Bidsy.
Bidsy?
Mm-hmm. And that was my name, and at school I was called Bree.
Uh-huh. But when you came to America, they at MGM, they were thinking about maybe changing your name.
They wanted to call me Angela Marlowe.
Okay.
That was the big...
All right. And actually, you had done your test for Gaslight with Hugh Marlowe, the actor,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Do you think that's where they picked up on the Marlowe process?
I think that's possible.
Possible?
It's a possibility.
But Angela Marlowe, you might
Angela
be sitting
Marlowe.
Here today.
Yes.
But did you say no to that?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I was very proud of my name because
it's a good name.
Yeah, it's a good name. And it certainly, you sort of remember it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a name that just sort of disappears easily. So, and also I was very proud of it, too. So I was glad to keep it.
Now, when you were at MGM and the structure of the studio, you're talking about seeing what different people were doing in departments, did you ever come under the thumb or the influence or the tutelage of the famous Lillian Burns? George Sidney's wife?
Yes, I did.
Who was the kind of the drama coach for everybody at the studio, right?
Yes.
Taught all the ladies how to walk and how to move and how to light a cigarette and all that.
Yes, she did, and they insisted that I work with her, and she was very helpful to me, actually, because I had to learn to play M in The Harvey Girls,
mm-hmm.
and that required that I had really a very good, strong American Western accent.
And M being a kind of a madam, actually, but...
She was a madam.
But in this movie, because it was a musical of the 40s was a saloon hostess,
exactly. But she really was a madam, and she was surrounded by all of these girls, and so
a very glamorous part.
Very glamorous, but also a woman of great authority,
mm-hmm.
and so we needed to work on that. Needed help, you know. And Lillian was okay. She did her thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd pass Lana Turner coming in for her session, and everybody had to go through those portals at one time or another.
Well, and those girls, a lot of them did have a similar style mm-hmm. in movies you would see, behave in a certain way.
That was Lillian Burns.
That
was absolutely
it's
Lillian
like the
Burns.
Singers with Kate Thompson all
exactly.
had kind of a sound after a while.
That's right.
Kate Thompson sound.
And I worked with Kate, you know, and Andy Williams was a backup singer in those days, and oh gosh, there's so much history attached
yes.
to it. It's incredible.
But fascinating history to mm-hmm. us, because we have the luxury of seeing those movies now, you know,
yes.
Harvey Girls again. Yes. But it was a very unusual part for you. Again, you're a kid mm-hmm. playing this this worldly dance hall hostess
right.
and working in some...
Showing your legs.
And singing, but after all that training you had as a singer and uh-huh. having a singing voice, they dubbed you in the movie.
Yes, they did.
How did that come about? And
well,
why
because
was that?
They needed a very deep, throaty voice, and I really didn't have that in those days. I had a high soprano, really, and I hadn't developed my chest voice at all.
Mm-hmm.
Hadn't worked to develop that. So I understand why they did that. They did the same with me and the Hoodlum Saint, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They dubbed me in that too. Mm-hmm. I don't blame them.
Now, Judy Garland. We're all fascinated by Judy Garland.
Yes.
What was she like to work with in that?
Well. Judy was Judy, you know. She was going through, thank God, a happy period. She was very thin. She was having a great romance with Vincent Minnelli. And she was probably happier. We hung around waiting for her less, I think, on that movie than people did subsequently.
Well,
but we waited a lot. I mean, yeah. we were ready absolutely spit ready at 9 o'clock in the morning. She would arrive at 11:30, and she still wasn't ready. She played the scene her way, you know. I don't mean the scene in the movie. I'm talking about her scene in life, you know. Mm-hmm. Makeup, getting out of bed, getting there, not sleeping, sleeping, pills. It was all part of that era for her. But she was slim. And I used to ride back and forth to locations when we were shooting out way out in on the Warner Ranch. And we would share a limo together, and we'd chat away and talk. And she was just a happy person in that state. She was happy. Mm-hmm. It was when she had to get her act together and get out there and do her stuff. I think she resented it to a little bit, maybe. She would like to have been there off with her guy.
Mm-hmm. But they put up with her.
They put up with her.
At that point.
Yeah, always, yes.
Mm-hmm. And John Hodiak?
John Hodiak was, I think, starting his romance with Ann Baxter at that time. And he was a very charming man, but nothing extraordinary.
Uh-huh. That had a wonderful cast.
Yes, it was a great cast.
And it actually was a very good movie for you from the standpoint that it kind of showed you could be glamorous on screen, mm-hmm. that you could play something other than a Brit, because mm-hmm. you'd kind of been playing British girls
right.
up until then. Mm-hmm. But it also did, I think, kind of, rather than capitalize on you by putting you in a lead, mm-hmm. kind of made you a supporting player
yes.
in the eyes of the studio anyway, or the studio had planned that.
They I think realized that they could put me in various slots with ease, and they chose to utilize that, mm-hmm. my ability to characterize and play different roles. And I was a very useful. It was like Agnes Moorehead. It was mm-hmm. the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to play some glamorous and some very de-glamorized roles, mm-hmm. depending what it was. You know, playing the Queen of France was very glamorous, you know, and it got to look good and wear magnificent costumes and so on and that sort of thing. So I certainly got to dress up a lot.
See, I always thought that was the great thing about your career, because as a moviegoer, I never knew where you were going to show up next or in what form or how, which I thought was a great way to have a career, but it must have been maybe frustrating to you that you wanted more than that.
Well, I wanted to play Lady de Winter, who was
in the Three Musketeers.
Yes, in the Three Musketeers, and not the Queen of France. And that's when I went to L.B. Mayer and I said, Mr. Mayer, please let me play. This is a perfect role for me. And, you know, it would really advance my career at the studio. Nope. He said, no, we want you to play the Queen of France. And Lana's going to play Lady de Winter. So that was the end of that. You know, I couldn't argue with the king. So.
Mm. And you said at one point, I had read that you said that was kind of the point at which you knew that you weren't going to go to the top of the class at MGM. Mm,
absolutely. It's very true.
Mm-hmm.
And I left at the end of the eighth year I left. I signed a new contract with MGM after my first 7 years. And then the second year of that contract, I thought, I've got to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So I did.
Now, in the meantime, you'd done two films with Ethel Barrymore.
Yes.
And I understand you had an Ethel Barrymore pool at your house.
Yes, I do.
Why so named?
Well, because during the shooting of,
The Red Danube?
Kind Lady.
Kind Lady.
Kind Lady. She became quite ill. She was not well anyway, and she was sort of in a wheelchair, you know. And luckily, she played the role in the wheelchair, and it worked fine. But she did become ill. And for 3 weeks, we were out, but we were still paid. So We took the money and we dug a swimming pool. It was absolutely wonderful. And the actor, the English actor
Morris Evans,
used to come out to my house, and he and Peter would dug all the holes for the rose bushes. And he loved gardening. He had a green thumb, and he was such a nice man. He was one of the sweethearts of the acting profession, and he'd done. The G.I. Hamlet, you remember?
Uh-huh, exactly.
During the war.
Touring all over with a version of Hamlet that was kind of cut down and adaptable to the soldiers.
Yes, he was very nice.
You mentioned Peter. Now, we have to talk about mm-hmm. your wonderful husband, Peter Shaw. In the meantime, you'd met this young actor mm-hmm. who was testing at MGM, mm-hmm. Peter Shaw, a mm-hmm. Very good-looking actor, and you did the test with him.
Yes, I did.
And something wonderful came out of that test, not for Peter, except maybe it was good for Peter because.
Yes, it was the deciding moment when I said to Peter, darling, you can't act. Give it up.
Right on the table.
He'd had a few years. He'd been under contract to MGM for, I think, 3 years. And it had helped him out of his leaving the Army. He'd been in the Army for 7 years, and he'd worked, you know, and he's trained as an actor, as a young man. He'd been in Rep in England and so on. And he was the best-looking man in the world.
Errol Flynn type.
Just, exactly. Anyway, we were so glad we found each other when we did. And we were introduced, of course, through Herd Hatfield, who
played Dorian Gray.
So we were going off to this house party in the Ojai Valley in California, and Herd arranged for this young English fella to pick me up at my house. And he did. And we never looked back. We just stuck together like glue, you know, for 53 years.
53 years.
It was a wonderful, wonderful marriage.
Now, also out of that screen test that Peter took, that you told him he shouldn't be an actor, something wonderful came for you, though.
Yes.
Right.
And that, of course, was the State of the Union. Capra saw the test. Also, don't forget, Kate Hepburn saw the test. And she was a very strong championed me always. She recognized that here was a kid who was not the run-of-the-mill, you know, and she certainly wasn't run-of-the-mill. And God bless her, she appreciated that, and she said, sign that girl. She's the one for this role. She couldn't do better.
A great, great property.
Yeah.
Directed by Frank Capra with Spencer Tracy Ann, Katharine Hepburn, and Van Johnson.
Yes.
Great
yes.
cast.
Wonderful movie.
And yes, wonderful movie. But again, it's interesting because you're like, what, 22?
Yes.
And you're having a romance in the movie with Spencer Tracy, who I think is 47.
How about that?
And Hepburn is 38. And you've taken him away from her and everything. So that's, again, incredible age difference, and but great company to be working in.
That's something I have to remember, and I know you're aware of it, that I always worked really with the best people. I just had these incredible opportunities to work with the best. And I mean, you're as good as the people you're with, really. If you have to realize that.
Now, also in there, you worked with another giant, Cecil B. DeMille, in one of his great epics, Samson and Delilah.
You bet.
That was on Lonot, I believe.
That was on a Lonot, from MGM.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And what was that experience like?
Well, that was like being let out of school because, you know, MGM was, they used to call it the factory. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it was. Everything was very strict over there. Everybody was very controlled, especially the contract players. Certain things were expected. And they really held you on a short rein at MGM. Whereas when you went to Paramount, it was like going into this kind of wonderful, easygoing country club, you know. Everybody had these kind of open-door dressing room situations. You had Danny Kaye, you had Sinatra, you had all kinds of people kind of drifting around Bogey, and they were all kind of in and out of each dressing. At the end of the shooting day, they'd all gather in one or the other dressing rooms and have a drink. You'd be invited in to have a cocktail, you know, before you went home. And the sound stages were smaller, and it was a wonderful, warm, comfortable, nice atmosphere. Mm. And so going over there, as I say, was like being let out.
Unfortunately, we do have to say that Paramount had probably more alcoholic stars between
surprised.
Crosby and Alan Ladd and, you know, you Veronica go. Lake and a lot of Gail Russell and a lot of those people. Isn't that interesting, though, that I remember that right across the street was a restaurant called Lucy's.
Oh, very
where they could
well.
Go at lunch and all have,
yes.
you know, have drinks and stuff, which now, I'm sure wasn't allowed at MGM.
Oh, no.
But they all became, I mean, there were so many of them that became, you know, kind of roaring alcoholics while they were working there.
Never thought of that, but of course
sorry
it
to
was.
Say.
No.
But good atmosphere. What
yes.
was DeMille like to work with?
Well, DeMille was a hard taskmaster, but a friendly man, warm man. He had a sort of way of, you know, he'd kind of ponder everything and very carefully, and he would talk to you in very kind of serious tones about everything, because he considered everything he was doing to be frightfully important, which it was, and an awful lot of research and thought, and he wanted to share all that with you all the time. He was not a small talk man. I mean, if you asked him a question, he'd give you a 3-4 hour answer kind of thing. But he was okay. I didn't have any quarrel with him. I always said he was a bit of a foot fetish person, because he was terribly involved with how people's feet were going to look in sandals. And Edith Head warned me, she said, he'll probably come to the first dress fitting and he'll want to see your feet. So have a good scrub and we'll put you in sandals,
it's
sort of incredible sort
like
of
that.
Sandals around the legs, you know, with these ties and so on. But he didn't say that's what he was doing, but that's what he was doing. Uh-huh. He was looking at your feet. You know.
But that was also a very prestigious film to be in at that time.
Oh, very much so.
It was one of
the
major films in 1949.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It came open with a big splash,
right.
You know. And I got a tremendous amount of attention from it, because I was killed in such a wonderfully theatrical way, you know, with that spear going right through me and coming out the other side. People used to stop me on
the
street.
On your wedding night, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes, on my wedding night. With Hedy Lamarr gloating in the distance,
uh-huh.
Yes.
So we had talked about MGM, and you decided it was time to go and get out of there. But that was also the period, wasn't it, that Dorry Sherry had come over to MGM and was kind of changing the whole philosophy of the studio.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people were either leaving or being let go, major stars, because they thought they could hire them whenever they needed them. They didn't have to pay them under contract anymore.
They
so
did
that,
that
whole
with me.
That whole structure was changing so much.
Oh, absolutely. It was huge year, and of course television was looming,
right,
you see.
Exactly.
So the studios were getting a little bit cold feet at that point, and Doric brought in a different group of people who were managing everything, and head of production was new, and they did Battleground, and mm-hmm. they made some very dark movies, you mm-hmm. know.
Asphalt Jungle.
And, can I say Nancy Davis came in,
right.
Nancy Reagan, and she was certainly a Dorry Sherry import
right.
at that time, and played a lot of good movies. But those of us who had sort of been in on the wave of the good old days of the 40s, we really didn't have a look in. So I left MGM, but then they hired me back again for Kind Lady,
mm-hmm.
which came quite a bit
mm-hmm.
later.
That your mother was also in?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she was still at the studio. No, she wasn't, no. No, she wasn't. I was thinking she had remained at the studio. But
then,
then
there were kind of tough days for you after that, right?
When yes,
they
were.
Freelancing.
Very, very thin.
Because,
thin
but I think
days.
It was tough for everybody in the studio era
yes.
then, because that it was basically had come to an end.
Well, it's very true.
Yeah.
So what did we do? I mean, for you know, for revenue,
mm-hmm.
I started in on television, and did a lot of live television. We would travel to New York. And we would do, Playhouse 90,
mm-hmm.
and Matinee Theater, and I forget all the various names
Robert
of the theaters.
Robert Montgomery Presents.
Robert Montgomery Presents. He did some very good ones.
Mm-hmm.
I did some good work with him. I also did work with Ronald Coleman. You remember when Ronald Coleman had this little company, what was it called? Four Star Theater. And did some lovely work with him. Always lovely little things, very, very nice. The String of Beads, I always remember that one by Somerset Maugham
mm-hmm.
that I did with Ronnie.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was working, but on a very small scale.
Now Peter, meanwhile, has stopped being an actor, but became a very successful agent.
Yes. He went to work for Bert Allenberg at William Morris, and he had a wonderful career
mm-hmm.
over there.
And then later became second in command at MGM for several
right.
years,
right?
Right,
you are.
So
yes.
he did very well with that.
Oh, yeah. He had a wonderful, wonderful career. And through it all, at the beginning, he never had anything to do with managing or suggesting. I mean, he certainly suggested who my agent should be.
Or Oh, I see.
No, he didn't.
You mean taking charge of your career?
Yeah, no, he didn't take charge of my career at that point. He didn't. That was something that one of us had to be the breadwinner. And there was a time when he was a breadwinner and I was, you know, piddling around doing television.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the time came, he dropped everything and came and he became the guider and the decider for me.
Uh-huh. So then in the mid-50s, after going through kind of a bleak period, and mm-hmm. in fact, there's one movie that I know you've kidded about before that you did in a supermarket.
Yes.
Where they shot the whole thing in a supermarket.
Yeah, it's called The Key Man.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you were doing whatever you could to make ends meet.
Oh, yes.
But then you two things that at least looms out that was a big change for you. One was doing The Court Jester with Danny Kaye, mm-hmm. which was a prestigious film, maybe the best film Danny Kaye ever made. Mm-hmm. And you have a wonderful, glamorous part in that.
Yes.
And a fun part.
Yes.
The vessel with the pestle and the, mm-hmm. or
this
the valise.
The brew that is true. Yes.
Wonderful. Yeah. And then about the same time, you made your Broadway debut in Hotel Paradiso.
That's right.
And didn't that have a big effect on you? Because right after that, you start appearing in a lot of really prestigious films like The Long Hot Summer and Reluctant Debutante, things like that. So you're
right.
No longer working in supermarkets.
No, absolutely. You're dead right there. Yes.
So how did Hotel Paradiso and the Broadway beginnings come into your life?
Just by chance. Hotel Paradiso was produced in 1957, so mm-hmm. it was 7 years into the 50s,
mm-hmm.
done a lot of television, things. I'd always had this rankling feeling in my head that I must get back to Broadway, that I really hadn't proven myself as an actress unless I pitted myself against the Broadway critics. You know, I hadn't really been judged fairly and squarely. Was I a real actress or was I just a, you know, whatever. So I, at that point, I had an invitation to come to Broadway by a British director, Peter Glanville. Peter was going to direct this French farce with the great Bert Lahr. Now, I knew Bert Lahr because he was the Cowardly Lion.
Sure.
And, I mean, as a British actress, I certainly had never seen him in vaudeville, but I'd seen him in that movie, that great, great movie. So I knew he was a terribly funny man. And I was invited to come to New York and read for the role. So I got on a plane, and I went and stayed at the Algonquin, and I read for Peter Glanville. He said, well, dear, he said, you'll have to work on your voice. It's too high. Got to lower it. You've got to learn to project. I said, well, I did learn. He said, you've got to relearn, because of course I'd been working in motion pictures for so long, I didn't have to project at all. Well, you do it to a degree, but nothing like you have to in a theater with no microphones. So, and they didn't use microphones in those days. Maybe they had a shotgun in the wings, I'm not quite sure, maybe. But anyway, I did the bit of work that he requested that I should do, came back, and I opened in the play. And I got nice reviews, a wonderful cast, you know, and I went back to California, mm-hmm. brought my children with me, they all came, and rented a flat in New York City, and that was when I was on the stage with Sandra Lee, the wonderful little who played in Peter Pan.
Tinkerbell.
Yeah, Tinkerbell, uh-huh. That's right. Anyway.
But it also got people thinking about you as a Broadway performer, I'm sure. Many people think of you in those terms that hadn't before.
Yes, I think they saw me for the first time, you know. They didn't really associate this woman all done up with stuff and nonsense with the girl who'd been in movies.
Mm-hmm. So then came The Long Hot Summer.
Yes, The Long Hot Summer.
And Orson Welles. Another great people. Martin Ritt directing.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Newman and Joanna
Great
Woodward.
Directors. Mm-hmm. Great directors. Over and over and over again. Just
and what
best.
Was Orson Welles like to work with?
Well, we got along, you know. He wanted the last shot in the film, and Marty wanted to do it differently. He wanted it a two-shot with the two of us. And Orson just wanted that last shot. So I wasn't about to fight with him, so we gave it to him.
And then you worked with another great director, Vincent Minnelli.
Yes.
On The Reluctant Debutante with Rex Harrison and Kate Kendall.
Now there was an experience, yeah. 12 weeks in Paris.
Not bad.
Not bad.
And heady company again.
Oh, very much so.
Now,
yes.
Was Kate Kendall ill at that point?
Very.
She used to
have blood transfusion every morning. But Rex was wonderful to her. He took care of her like a baby. He really did. And she got through the movie, and she was just fading away and died very soon after.
Yeah, it's a delightful movie.
It's a fun movie.
Yeah, delightful movie.
Beautiful to look at.
Uh-huh. And then also The Dark at the Top of the Stairs with Delbert Mann directing, Robert Preston and Dorothy McGuire, which I believe is the first movie in which you ever had a kiss. 17 years and some 25 movies after you'd been working, you had your first screen kiss by Robert Preston.
That's amazing. You know, I'd never thought of that. I think you're right. Yes, I think you're right. I never got to be the one who got kissed, you know? I got lots of kisses at home, though.
Even better.
Yeah, much better.
So, okay, now your career is going along. Are you satisfied with your career at this point, the direction it's going in or what you're doing?
What I'm doing now, yes. Yes, I am. Things come out of the woods, you know. I never quite know where some interesting idea is going to be presented to me. So, you know, I've had such a full career that at this stage of the game, I'm ready to sit back and kind of watch and listen and just not take anything that comes my way. And I am offered a lot of guest spots, and I choose not to do them. For the simple reason that I don't think I do them very well. Isn't that funny? I just don't feel very comfortable. It depends. If it's in a kind of a comedy sitcom, it's very hard to sort of pick up the pace of everybody who's been doing the show
and
for 5 years and working
forever.
With a group, yes. You've almost got to be, you've got to have a bit of stand-up in you to do that, and I don't have that. That isn't something, that's not one of the strings in my bow. So I'm very careful.
Okay, and also at this point we have to point out, you have two children. You and Peter have a son and a daughter, Anthony and Deirdre.
And Deirdre.
And also around this time you build a house in Malibu. And also, just as you kind of get in your wonderful new house you've always wanted, and a family stable life, you get an offer to come back to New York again and do, I believe, A Taste of Honey. So you have to make this decision on whether to stay home or go back to Broadway.
It was a difficult decision, let me tell you. It was the first time in my career, in my married life, where I was absolutely happy to be just mom and to be a wife and to be at home. And this is what sometimes happens in careers. It's so tough. You have to make decisions. And I made a decision, no, I wouldn't go. But I remember this convertible coming down the driveway of my house in Malibu at that time. And it was Tony Richardson, brilliant director, just on Sanctuary, or was doing Sanctuary at 20th Century Fox. And George Devine, the great director, who was going to be his co-director. And it was very hard to say no. And Peter really wanted me to go back to Broadway because I wasn't doing anything of great interest at that point on the coast. So it was very wrenching for me to leave the kids, but I did go. And they came back. And
you're playing a mother of a young girl, but the young girl is what, like 3 years younger than you are in real life? Joan Plowright.
At
that point is having an affair with, and later marriage to, Laurence Olivier.
Yes, exactly. So there was all of that going on.
Uh-huh.
And the production was very well received. It was, you know, it got very good reviews. Didn't run that long. I left the cast. I always had a 6-month contract. That was the only way I would ever go to New York. And
that was very rare then, wasn't it?
Yes, very rare. I was about the only person, I think, at that time who managed to get that agreement with a producer. But otherwise, I would never have gone. As it was, I took the children. They all came, and we had an apartment on Fifth Avenue in New York City. We had a wonderful Scottish nanny who came with us, and she gave them their lessons, and we managed to stick together. But Peter wasn't there, and that was terrible. That was just awful.
You have really run the gamut of people you've worked with. As we mentioned, you've worked with Judy Garland, Orson Welles, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, the whole group, and Elvis Presley. You played his mother. You were 7 years older, I think, but you played his mother in Blue Hawaii. What was that experience like?
Well, I was obviously awed by the, you know, being in the presence. And but he was an awfully nice young man in those days. He always was a wonderfully nice young man, very caring person. He had his terrible problems, a very personal nature. But in those days, he'd just come out of the army. He was fit, he was slender, and he was at top of his form. And he couldn't have been nicer to me. We had a lovely time. It was a wonderful location. We were on Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. And we were living in that this wonderful kind of beach community and sort of resort. And I'll never forget it. It was really wonderful.
Did you get to spend much time with him?
Yes, we sat around the set, and I had some wonderful scenes with the man who played my husband, who and the three of us, you know, having breakfast together. And she was such a funny character, you know, and her whole reaction to her son, who she didn't understand at all, you know, and she was a real kind of Southern Belle type, you know, and she was going on, give me some sugar, honey, you know, kind of thing. And he loved it. He thought it was terribly funny. Uh-huh. It was very sweet.
Right around that same time, you did Peter Shaw's, as we said, Second Command now at MGM.
Yeah.
And you did a favor for Peter and Vincent Minnelli with a movie that we have at Turner Classic Movies, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
You're one of the few people who know about that.
I know, but
I guess the cat's out of the bag now.
Yeah, well, if it's not, I've let it out several times.
Yeah.
Yeah, but tell us about that, how that...
Well, it came about because Ingrid Thulin, the great Swedish actress who played opposite Glenn Ford in The Four Horsemen, she spoke English, but it was very hard to understand her English. And they were really in a dilemma.
This was a huge, huge picture.
Huge
big picture. Budget.
It was a remake of the great movie which had been so successful in the 20s. So
made Valentino a big star.
Yes.
Yes.
Indeed. And they wanted to remake it with all the noise and panoply that they could gather. So when they had a run through a preview, they discovered that the audience didn't know what she was saying. So they gave me trying to remember who was over Peter at that point at MGM. It's awful, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, he asked Peter if he thought I would consider doing this, that we wouldn't tell anybody I was going to do it, that I would simply do it.
Redub the whole
Redub the entire part. And so they sent me the script, and I read through it, and I practiced my best Swedish accent, which I picked up from Ingrid, and I did it. I stood in a looping room, you know, with the lines going across the screen, mouthing her, you know, fitting my words to her mouth. And it took me probably 2 days to do it.
Amazing.
But
did they tell Ingrid Thulin about it?
Well, they must have done.
Uh-huh.
But it is fascinating. It was a big secret.
Because you watch that movie, mm-hmm. And you're aware of her from her Swedish films, but all of a sudden this voice sounds terribly familiar in a way. You say,
really?
Uh-huh. And then it dawns on you when you know, then you pick it up. But I think that's one of the great, for years, one of the great Hollywood secrets.
Yes.
That whole part in a very important film was redubbed by you.